what's happening to the house and who's getting the kids. There are three standout issues in the Brexit divorce. Firstly, the custodial argument, the rights of the 3.2 million EU citizens living in the UK. That's important to Barnier, but Britain can't guarantee their status in a no-deal scenario. The UK's solicitors are much more concerned with the settlement, arguing that the exit bill must depend on the outcome of trade talks. And thirdly, the sticking point, how to stave off a hard border in Ireland. Neither side has a solution. In Tuesday's episode, we honed in on trade, number 110 with William Bain. Today we're crossing the Irish Sea on the last Ryanair flight out of Stansted. Frustratingly, the issue goes back to the Troubles, something most in Dublin and Belfast would rather stay in the 20th century. Specifically, the Good Friday Agreement, its second strand. A key tenet of the peace process was the avoidance of a hard border between the north and south and the continued operation of the Common Travel Area, an open border area made up of the UK and Northern Ireland, Ireland, the Isle of Man and the Channel Islands. The internal borders of the Common Travel Area are subject to minimal controls, if at all, and can usually be crossed without any formal documentation. That's why you don't need a passport or indeed any ID for a coach trip from Belfast to Dublin or as you cross the Severn Bridge for the latest instalment of the Six Nations in Cardiff. In Florence, Mrs. May insisted this arrangement should remain in place, not wanting to jeopardise the Irish peace process. What she didn't say was how that arrangement could be reconciled with the UK's potential departure from the EU's customs union and single market. So, Brexit probably represents the single greatest economic and foreign policy challenge to the Irish state since the Second World War. Who better to confront the issue than Tony Connolly, Europe editor for RTE, Ireland's public broadcaster. He explained the contentious, at times mystifying issue of the Irish border, what's going to happen to Baileys, and why Mum and Dad might not reach a harmonious settlement.
Ollie.
Hey, Tony, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Yes, very well, thank you.
Great.
Let's just get straight into it pretty much, because obviously I don't want to hold you up and miss your miss the press conference.
not that we're going to know anything from the press conference.
Not that it'll be particularly useful anyway. Tony, a sum total of 36 hours has passed between our first conversation and this interview. I like to think of myself as a bit of a speed reader, but even I couldn't read your book in that window, Amazon delivery permitting. However, I understand its pages contain a scoop, namely a suppressed revenue report which concludes that an open customs border with Ireland is impossible after Brexit, going so far as to call such thinking naive. Could you talk us through that?
Yeah, so when I was writing the book, I was in touch with a source at the Revenue Commissioners in Ireland for some time, and he had described how a unit in the Revenue Commissioners, about a year before the referendum, had set about looking at the implications of a possible leave vote. Of course, nobody at the time ever believed that there would be a leave vote, so this was always supposed to be a historical curiosity. But they did the scoping, they did a forensic examination of what would happen if there was a leave vote, and when the vote actually happened, at least they had a report ready to give the government on the day after the referendum. Obviously, everyone was in a state of shock, but the Revenue Commissioners, I think, prided themselves in having a document ready. However, in the months after the referendum results, that report was updated to take account of new information about trade flows, about how Irish exporters and traders were anticipating things, and they were just gathering more information all the time. So the copy of the report, which I managed to obtain, had been updated as recently as March, and I was given a copy on the condition that it was for my book, not for my day-to-day reporting for RTE. And because the book was published just on the 5th of October there, that was at that point we felt we could run the report. And as you know, it caused quite a bit of a reaction politically in Ireland. The opposition accused the government of suppressing the report, of trying to keep the public and the economic and business sector in the dark. My understanding of the report was that it was never really meant to be published. It was more of an internal aid memoir for revenue commissioners to keep abreast of all the developments. But having said all that, the findings of the report are fairly stark, fairly sobering. And obviously these people know their stuff. They know the EU customs code. They know all of the implications of Brexit. Obviously, as officials and technocrats, if you like, they will not. They will give you a fairly unvarnished vision of what Brexit means for Ireland. But following the publication of our report, just after the book came out, there was a bit of a fuss in the Irish Parliament about it. And I think the government has now decided to publish the report in full. And that's where things stand.
So the wider political significance then, as you described it, stark and sobering. What are the practical, pragmatic repercussions of it now being in the public sphere?
Well, I think the most interesting dilemma for the government is that the revenue commissioners, I suppose, did due diligence. Once Brexit happened, the revenue commissioners had to look at the real political hotspot of the Irish border between north and south, because Northern Ireland would be remaining outside the customs union and outside the single market. And of course, that was the most politically explosive issue in Brexit, on Brexit for Ireland. So they looked at ways of how to establish a seamless border. They visited a number of EU third country borders in Europe. The one that they looked at in particular was the Norway-Sweden border, which, as you probably know, has received quite a bit of attention. Norway's outside the customs union. Sweden is inside the customs union. So they went there and they looked at how the Swedes and Norwegians were using technology to speed up the process. They looked at Switzerland and so on. They looked at other EU third country frontiers. But at a certain point, the revenue commissioners were told by the government that they had to cease their technical work, because at that point, the negotiations and, I suppose, the Irish government's strategic posture was becoming very political. And in essence, they didn't want the Irish revenue commissioners to be constructing a technical fix that would get the UK off the hook. In other words, if the revenue commissioners did due diligence and said, look, if we do X, Y, and Z, if we have this scanning technology, if we have ANPR cameras at the border, if we shift road stations a little bit south of the border, then perhaps, you know, that will make it a more seamless experience for freight drivers. If they did that, then the Irish government felt, well, look, you're just creating a gift-wrapped solution for the British government. And so the revenue commissioners had to effectively stop their work. And it then became a very political narrative then within the negotiations. And since around the spring of this year, the message from the Irish government and indeed the European Commission Task Force is that it's actually Britain's responsibility to solve this problem, not Ireland's responsibility or Europe's responsibility.
Who would want to make things easy for the UK, I guess?
That's a question.
So you mentioned really heavy freight, well, not really heavy, but freight traffic across the border. As I understand it, approximately 13,000 daily lorry border crossings across 12 approved routes.
Yeah.
Let's say a hard border goes up. What's going to happen to those commercial trips?
Well, it's going to be, frankly, a nightmare, because there, you know, trade and the movement of freight has been an all-Ireland phenomenon. It's pretty seamless. It's completely seamless, actually. You wouldn't know the border was there. You wouldn't even know when you crossed it at the moment. That's the reality that we've had since the peace agreement and also the single market coming into effect in 1992. I mean, one freight company I spoke to in Belfast said, look, they might get several orders a day to shift stuff at short notice across the border. But if you had to prepare customs documents in that kind of time frame, your system would just grind to a halt. Beyond that, there is a much more worrying aspect to this. And that is, what kind of infrastructure would you have at the border? Would you have simply observation cameras that can read a license plate from a distance? Those have been cut down in Republican parts of Northern Ireland. If that happens, then you'll have to secure those cameras. you may have to secure any other customs infrastructure. And by doing that, you are perhaps creating a target for dissident Republicans. And this isn't simply a fanciful daydreaming. This is actually something that the PSNI, the Police Service in Northern Ireland, have spoken about in terms of their concerns about this. And, you know, one senior intelligence source I spoke to for the book described that sequence, you know, that once you put infrastructure there, the risk is that becomes a target, and then you have to have armed police to protect that target, and you can see how the situation might escalate. So those are typically some of the problems that you would have if you have a hard border.
Absolutely, and I would like to come back to the Good Friday Agreement in just a moment, but sticking on trade for the time being, cross-border traffic is significant, we've just established that, but what about trade across the Irish Sea? It represents, as I understand it, a far higher volume of imports and exports for both the North and Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very good point, because a lot of the attention goes on the Irish border and the North-South trading element. But really, from the Irish Republic's point of view, the big trade is not with Northern Ireland, it's with Great Britain. The volumes of trade both ways are enormous, 17 billion in imports from the UK to the Republic of Ireland, around 15.5 billion in imports from the Republic of Ireland to the UK. I mean, you can boil it down to say that the relationship between the two sides is like an old-fashioned notion of marriage. Ireland feeds Britain, and Britain keeps Ireland warm at night because there's huge energy flows across the Irish Sea. So, you're just disrupting that particular relationship. But in a serious note, I mean, there are major concerns about the effect of customs tariffs and duties on, especially on the agri-food sector. If you even take beef alone, we send 270,000 tons of beef across the Irish Sea every year to the UK. That is worth about €2.5 billion in revenue for the Irish beef sector, which is, you know, politically a very sensitive sector. And you know, if there are tariffs on that, you know, you are looking at major disruption. And the problem for the Irish beef sector alone is that there isn't an alternative market that can take up that volume of beef. So that's a major concern. I mean, we talk also about dairy produce. One thing I established was that to actually make Bailey's Irish cream, the liqueur, there are something like 5,000 border crossings by trucks every year in the production of Bailey's, because they have a plant in Dublin and they have a plant in outside Belfast in a place called Mollusk. But the milk that they get comes from all over the island, and that milk might cross the border several times. In fact, Bailey's uses nearly 5% of the milk pool in Ireland for its production. And so that, again, is going to run into trouble if you have tariffs on dairy, which can be up to, 20, 30%.
So we can expect to hear the Shires screaming in 2019 when it comes around to Christmas time, I guess.
That's one of the casualties. You know, what are people going to do without their Baileys?
It's collateral damage of war. Yeah, I guess so. We will come back to that, because, as I understand it, Pascal Donohoe has announced the creation of a Brexit loan scheme to particularly aimed at those agricultural SMEs. But as I said, yeah, we'll come back to it. Back to the peace process, as you mentioned, from this side of the Irish Sea, the introduction of frontier points and customs posts would seem jeopardise the Good Friday Agreement, particularly if you're talking about, as you mentioned, armed PSNI officers guarding ANPR cameras. Is that a legitimate concern? Is it a slightly Anglo-Belfast-centric understanding, or are those feelings shared in Dublin?
I think in general they are shared in Dublin, and I suppose the Irish government would look at the risks in terms of the potential for a security escalation on the border if you have infrastructure there. But also it goes perhaps deeper than that, because the Good Friday Agreement was a very meticulous and hard-fought arrangement between two sovereign governments that provided a a legal and constitutional space for two conflicting identities to be able to live and breathe and relate to one another. And also part of that process was, you know, peace and prosperity. And the prosperity word is underlined, I think, for Irish diplomats, because, you know, peace and prosperity go hand in hand. If you suddenly put a border into that equation, then prosperity is threatened. And not only that, there are, I think, 12 areas in the Good Friday Agreement governing cross-border cooperation. And that's very, very important for nationalists. And you know, they signed up to the Good Friday Agreement believing that their interests and their identity and their all-Ireland ethos and aspirations would be safeguarded. But if those north-south institutions like waterways, like language, like trade, tourism, fisheries, all of those things, if those are suddenly and abruptly interrupted by Brexit, then it throws the whole trajectory of the Good Friday Agreement off balance. And that's really the argument the Irish government is making. This is not just a trade issue. It's about maintaining the careful balance that the Good Friday Agreement was able to achieve.
This change in customs relationship is going to affect all EU member states, but it's pretty clear from what we've just spoken about that it's going to be the most profound in Ireland, because it is the only EU nation to share a land border with the UK, and its repercussions, particularly in the north and its relationship. But why can't the border have a unique arrangement? It's a unique situation, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think they are looking at finding a unique solution, and the language is very important here because, you know, I think the Irish government and the European Commission felt that Britain's attitude in the negotiations was that this is a straightforward technocratic fix. You know, we can do this with you know, cameras and so on. And at his last news conference in September, David Davis said that the Irish question is unique and complex, and those two words were not there by accident. I think the British side was encouraged to put that word complex in there because it reflects that Britain realises how serious this is. I mean, they are looking long-term at what this means in terms of finding solutions. We reported last week, and this is also in my book, that the European Commission had an internal memo which they shared with the Irish government, which set out the idea of having agriculture on an all-island basis. That would allow those flows of milk and milk produce and animal produce up and down across the Irish border. It would allow those flows to continue because Northern Ireland and the Republic would be part of one agricultural unit. But it would mean that Northern Ireland would have to abide by all of the regulations that govern EU trade in agri-food and food and animal movements and so on. But again, that would also mean having controls not on the border, but having controls on the Irish Sea at ports at Larne and Belfast and airports and so on. But again, you know, once that happens, it's almost like the zero-sum game. Unionists get upset because they say that will undermine the constitutional link between Northern Ireland and Great Britain.
So given that unique exposure of Irish SMEs to the UK market, which we've already touched on, Fine Gael Finance Minister Pascal Donohoe has announced the creation of a €300 million Brexit loan scheme available at competitive rates. The scheme is intended to help bridge short-term working capital needs. That amounts to a subsidy, doesn't it, Tony? You could say hardly an instance of free trade, given its support by the relevant EU institutions.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think the whole question of state aid is often mentioned. I know that the Irish business sector, the Small Firms Association, IBEC, the Major Employers Confederation, the Irish Exporters Borders Association, and also the farming lobby have all raised this issue of relaxing state aid rules in the event of Brexit happening, or at least in the event of a hard Brexit. They want the government to lobby the European Commission that Ireland needs a special case when it comes to state aid, that the government should be allowed to subsidise companies that are hit by the sudden imposition of customs costs and expenses in terms of tariffs, also the disruption in supply chains. And, you know, there are key sectors geographically in Ireland where unemployment is a problem, and perhaps in counties like Cavan and Monaghan, the only major employers are either the agri-food trade, who supply food for the UK, or small SMEs that provide intermediate goods and inputs for products in the UK. And these are the most vulnerable sectors, and the impact on employment in those vulnerable low-income regions could be quite stark. So the government is pushing that, and I think from talking to European Commission officials, there will certainly be sympathy for Ireland on that score. Whether that goes so far as to relax state aid rules, we know what the Commission is like when it comes to the orthodoxy of competition law. It's unlikely that they will go down that route, but they may find other ways to alleviate the impact.
I know you've got to get off to a Michel Barnier press conference, so let's just quickly, if you could give us a summary. In your mind, what is the most likely outcome on the border, and what is the best possible outcome?
I think from the Irish government's point of view, the best possible outcome would be that Britain stays in the customs union, and certainly among many senior officials and cabinet ministers in Dublin that I speak to, they still think it's possible that Britain might do that, or that they will be able to negotiate something with the European Union that is as close as possible to what exists at the moment in terms of customs union. If that were the case, then of course you wouldn't have to have checks on the border. You wouldn't have to have checks at Irish ports, and traders wouldn't be subject to those tariffs and duties and so on. If it falls short of that, then I still think you are going to have some kind of checks on the Irish border through technology and through the flexible and imaginative solutions, that phrase that is embedded in the EU negotiating guidelines. But one senior European Council source said to me, look, we can't promise that the world is not going to change, because it is going to change, and there will be hardship because of Brexit. That's not in question.
Tony, that's absolutely brilliant, mate.
Lovely. Okay, that's great, Ollie.
Thanks, mate. Take it easy.
Thanks a lot. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tony is the author of Brexit in Ireland, The Dangers, the Opportunities, and the Inside Story of the Irish Response. Available on Amazon or in Waterstones if you happen to be on a decaying British high street. Get us on Twitter. I'm at Ollie Dugmore, OLIDUGMORE, or at T Connolly, RTE. Connolly is spelled CONNELLY, and as always, at Brexit Podcast. In our next episode, I'm going to be speaking to Henry Bolton, UKIP's newly elected leader. Don't miss it on Tuesday. The Brexit Podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, Warren Pohl, and Ollie Dugmore, with the theme music by the one and only Kevin MacLeod.